Welcome to All Sides with Amy Jurevich. It seems that every month there's a new acquisition, a new company up for grabs, or some multi-billion dollar sale. But where does the money for these sales actually come from? And why do we keep hearing about it? Private equity is the newer player in town. And they've been buying up companies from Toys R Us to Red Lobster in hopes of turning them around. However, one in five companies under private equity leadership go under. Are these multi-billion dollar deals an olive branch for struggling companies needed to succeed, or just another financial loophole? Joining us now is Megan Greenwell, author of the new book, Bad Company: Private Equity and the Death of the American Dream. Welcome to the show, Megan.
Thank you so much for having me, Amy.
All right, so we're going to have to start by explaining private equity in the simplest terms. What is private equity and why should we care about it?
So private equity is a system of financing in which firms bundle together money from all sorts of types of investors. So university endowments, public pension funds, ultra wealthy individuals, state sovereign wealth funds. And then they use that money to buy companies. But that money is actually the minority of any given deal. The majority of the deal is made up of bank loans. And so firms are taking out a tremendous amount of debt to acquire these companies. But the trick of the private equity system is the responsibility for that debt is assigned not to the firm that has made the decision to take out the loans, but actually to the company they're acquiring. So if the company goes under, the private equity firm has no legal responsibility to pay back the money that they took out in the company's name. And so you end up with this situation where there's sort of a split in incentives between what's good for the private equity firm and what's good for the company whose interests they are ostensibly representing as their owner.
Can you explain what the private part means, though? Because meaning not public. When big money's involved in, I think, public money, I always think like publicly traded, like the stock market. But what? How is it private versus public?
Right, exactly. So the source of money is all private. And it's not like a public company where theoretically anybody can, at least at a very low level, become a stockholder of that company. There's no way to, you know, for you or me to become a participant in a private equity deal. All of the money is coming from these outside investment groups or the bank loans.
Now, I mentioned your book. You first got interested, though, in private equity because a private equity firm bought the company you worked for. You used to be the editor-in-chief of Deadspin. And our listeners might remember Deadspin. It was a well-known sports news website that offered commentary on the world of sports. It was known for being provocative because the site challenged conventional thinking in the world of sports. So, Megan, editor-in-chief of Deadspin, sounds like a great job. How did private equity enter the picture for you?
Yeah, being editor-in-chief of Deadspin really was my dream job. And once I got there, I was sort of like, I'll stay as long as they'll have me. And I only lasted about a year and a half because about, you know, a little over a year into my tenure, we got purchased. We had been owned by Univision, the Spanish language broadcaster, and we got bought by a small Boston-based private equity firm called Great Hill Partners. And we all understood that our parent company needed to be acquired. Univision didn't really care about us. We were sort of not their core business. And so they were essentially taking a perspective of benign neglect toward us. And we wanted to see, you know, the business side souped up. We wanted to make more money. We weren't being like, you know, the stereotype of like overly pure journalists who are afraid of anything that makes money. And instead, what happened was this private equity firm came in and they immediately suggested cutting some of our most profitable kinds of content. And so I, as the editor in chief, was sort of saying, well, no, that doesn't make any sense. We will make less money if you do that. And it just became clear fairly quickly that they didn't actually care about making money for Deadspin because, like I say, there was this split in incentives where they were making their money by essentially slashing us to the bone and increasing their, you know, share of the revenue by doing that rather than by actually trying to make us money. And Deadspin was profitable and very, very popular. You know, we were really set up to succeed And it was really stunning to me that our new owners didn't really care if we lived or died, because the way the private equity system is set up, they could make their money either way.
Now, did you set out to write a book about this, or were you just trying to understand what happened to you at Deadspin when you started looking into private equity?
It was mostly that I was just trying to understand what had happened to me. I had written an essay on my last day at Deadspin called The Adults in the Room, which went more viral than anything I've ever written in my career. And I did have people come to me and say, you should write a book about this. It was all about my experience and sort of my failure to understand what was going on. And I really hesitated because I didn't want to write a book about my personal experience. And frankly, I didn't think enough people were going to buy a book that was all about media. But I just stayed really obsessed with the question of how exactly private equity does work and how it plays out in industries that, frankly, are much more important than provocative sports blogs, right? And so over a period of about 6 months, I just couldn't stop reading about how this plays out in other industries. And then I decided, you know, I can write a book that's a real narrative nonfiction treatment of this that is not about my own experience at all, but that follows characters who are sort of living through this. So I ended up spending about 2 years with each of my four primary protagonists, each representing one of four industries, retail, healthcare, media, and housing. And that was sort of my way in rather than writing about my own experience.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking about private equity with Megan Greenwell, author of the book Bad Company, Private Equity and the Death of the American Dream. And we can go into more detail about each of these later on, but your book, as you said, breaks down to four different stories and four different impacts. So you have a Toys R Us supervisor, a rural doctor, a local newspaper journalist, and an affordable housing organizer. So when I think of stories that I have heard about private equity, Toys R Us comes to mind, so that one checks out for me. I also think of Red Lobster, Wayfair, definitely newspapers, but not so much doctors or housing. Can you explain how private equity touches those industries?
Yeah, so healthcare and housing have been two newer areas of investment for private equity. They really both ballooned in the 2010s. And for, you know, complementary reasons, in housing, private equity started getting involved because housing prices crashed after the 2008 financial crisis, and because private equity firms figured out that they could get low interest loans from Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which are theoretically designed to give ordinary Americans low interest loans, but there's nothing stopping private equity from getting it too. So just the availability of cheap money is always very appealing to private equity firms. And then similarly in housing, you know, unfortunately, this was an effect of the Affordable Care Act. Because there was more guaranteed money in hospitals, private equity firms started looking and saying, well, there's nothing, you know, stopping us from essentially getting in on this. And so in both of those cases, these are progressive government policies intended to help ordinary Americans. And unfortunately, they also have these side effects of allowing, in some cases, very predatory firms to kind of swoop in and essentially do the opposite of what the policies were intended to do by taking advantage of ordinary Americans.
Are private equity sales something that are frowned upon in the financial world? Like who hates these deals, basically? Besides you, maybe.
I mean, the people that hate these deals are the people who are subject to these deals, right? So in healthcare, for example, doctors across the country are up in arms about what private equity has done. You know, you can talk to any doctor and they get unsolicited bids all the time from private equity firms, essentially saying, you know, we'll give you enough money to retire and don't worry about what happens to your practice after that. Within the finance world, no, absolutely. They're not at all considered controversial, even though the data is really clear that these do affect companies in a negative way. You know, like you said at the top, 10 times as many companies owned by private equity enter bankruptcy proceedings as other kinds of companies. So, I would argue that these deals should be more controversial, and certainly in fields that are considered sort of public services like healthcare, like housing, even like local media. It feels like perhaps private equity should be able to, be as ruthless as they want in quote unquote ordinary businesses, right? Whether that's retail or restaurants or whatever it is. But when you're looking at something like healthcare, this is making a meaningful dent in Americans' ability to get, gold standard hospital care, and particularly in rural areas. Private equity has taken a huge interest in rural hospitals in particular. And, if your rural hospital gets stripped of all of its services, there might not be anywhere for you to go for another 30, 40, 50 miles. This is the story I wrote about in my book, takes place in rural Wyoming. And, it's not like there's just another option across town, right? So it's not as controversial as it should be. And I think that's in large part because private equity is a field that is very poorly understood.
Yes, I'm trying to understand it as we talk right now, right? But I feel like I need an economics degree to truly understand where that money comes from and how the private equity firms and the people there make money. But let's back up for a second. Private equity firms advertise that they are taking troubled companies and that they can fix them. I mean, is that true? Do they sometimes fix things? Because, Toys R Us is back. It's inside Macy's, but it's, did they fix it?
Yeah, I mean, Toys R Us had 33,000 employees and 700 plus stores across the country. Now they have a couple of pop-ups in various Macy's stores. So I think pretty clearly
that's not fixing it. Okay.
that's okay. Pretty clearly not fixing it. There are plenty of successful private equity deals. It's not like everyone is a failure. To step back for a minute, private equity started in the 1960s with what they called bootstrap deals, which were essentially pumping money into small family-owned companies that showed, maybe the potential for expansion, but didn't have the liquid capital to do it. Mm-hmm. So, that feels like a fairly benign model. What's happened since then is the deals just got bigger and bigger and bigger. And as the deals got bigger and started affecting, a lot more people, both in terms of the workers, but also in terms of the communities that relied on those businesses, the success rate went way down, right? So you can look at a small family-owned company and say, yes, maybe this benefited the 200 employees, but Toys R Us had 33,000 employees. Mm-hmm. And a lot of those folks were, kind of scraping by on minimum wage. And all of a sudden they're laid off without the severance that was guaranteed in their contract. And so it's not that every private equity deal goes badly, but the academic research shows pretty clearly that 10 times as many of them do. So I think it is worth pushing back on this narrative that private equity firms are the only ones who can save the day, because A, they're not actually taking on any risk, right? They're not responsible for the loans taken out in the company's name. B, they make their very lucrative management fees regardless of whether the company is doing well or poorly. And so it's only the workers and the communities that have anything on the line here.
So using Toys R Us again as an example, was Toys R Us headed to bankruptcy and the private equity firm came in and bought them? Or like, is it a chicken or an egg thing? Like, does the company have to be struggling, or just do private equity firms buy companies, I guess, that are not struggling too?
Right. So private equity firms like to say that they're kind of swooping in to save the day with companies that ordinarily would not survive. That is somewhat true. They are attracted to what they call distressed assets. Toys R Us was actually still profitable. Their trend line was down because Walmart had become really dominant and because Amazon was just starting to come on the scene in like a world dominating kind of way, mm-hmm. at the time Toys R Us sold. But What was interesting to me about the Toys R Us deal is if their goal was to save this American institution, they didn't really take any of the steps that one would ordinarily think of as saving a company, right? So they never developed a real web strategy. They never focused on upgrading the in-store experience. There are plenty of retail chains that did survive Amazon's rise, right? There are plenty of retail chains that continue to do well. If you look at the National Retail Federation's list of the biggest retail chains in America, none of the top like 25 or 30 are owned by private equity. And I think that's really illustrative because there is a way to make it work in the retail world, but you have to have liquid capital. You have to be able to focus on things like making a web presence that can compete with Amazon, creating an in-store experience that Amazon can't provide. And there are plenty of chains that have done that well. But in the case of private equity-owned chains, because all of the money is swallowed up by loans, you know, Toys R Us fundamentally went out of business, not because of Amazon, but because they had $5 billion worth of loans. Even when they were still profitable, between 90 and 120% of their profit margins were going just to pay down the interest on these loans. So there was really no way for them to survive, not because they were completely doomed by Amazon, but because there was no way to try to be competitive because there was no money.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and we're discussing private equity and how it runs the country, even if many Americans don't know much about it. Author Megan Greenwell is staying with us. Her book is Bad Company, Private Equity and the Death of the American Dream. And coming up, we're going to talk more about the humans behind the deals, the people making them, and the people impacted. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Public Radio is here for you. It doesn't matter how old you are, how big your home is, or what kind of car you drive. WOSU and NPR connect you to news and information in civil conversations. That's why 43 million Americans listen to NPR each week. WOSU is part of our community, covering and discussing issues important to you, standing with the facts. Meet the moment with WOSU. Go to wosu.org/protect.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. From healthcare to your favorite TV show, private equity firms have been acquiring and managing companies in every industry across America. But is that healthy for the country? And what is the human cost of these firms? When hospitals and nursing homes get bought out, do patients start losing services? And when restaurant chains get bought up, do jobs start to vanish? Or do private equity firms do what they say they're trying to do? They save struggling businesses. Still with us is Megan Greenwell, author of Bad Company, Private Equity and the Death of the American Dream. Thanks again for being here, Megan.
Thanks so much.
So you did trace, we did mention earlier the history a little bit, but can you talk about how long has private equity been around? You mentioned the 60s. Is that when it started?
Yeah, so it started with these bootstrap deals in the 1960s, but it really started to balloon into its current form in the 80s. You know, you think of movies like Wall Street, books like Barbarians at the Gate, kind of the corporate raiders era. Nobody wants to call it corporate raiding anymore, but those were the seeds of the modern day private equity industry. And from the 80s until now, you've just seen it get bigger and bigger and bigger and dominate a greater and greater share of the American economy.
Let's go to some of the people behind these deals. Are the leaders of private equity firms, are they one person? Is it a group of people? Are these the richest people in America that we've never heard of?
In a lot of cases, yes, they are the richest people we've never heard of. Or in some cases, you may have heard of them, but you don't know that they're private equity executives and that that's how they've made their money. So in both the 2020 and 2024 cycles, Steven Schwartzman was the biggest single donor to Donald Trump's campaign. The reason he has so much money is because he runs Blackstone, which is the largest private equity firm on earth. I live in New York City, where the central branch of the New York Public Library is named after Steven Schwartzman. But I think if you asked 100 people going in and out of the New York City Public Library, they would not be able to tell you that the reason that building carries that name is because of private equity money. So, you know, in a lot of cases, these firms were founded by one or two or three people. And it is a it is an industry where people have very long tenures. So a lot of the people who founded these firms in the 80s are still in charge of these firms. And so, you know, they're incredibly powerful people. They have built very successful businesses, but I'd argue they have done it on the backs of a lot of ordinary working Americans from whom they have stripped, you know, their jobs, their livelihoods, their ability to get health care, their housing, etc.
Did you look into the politics of all of this? Because public equity firms have been around through Republican administrations, Democratic administrations. I'm sure there's both Republicans and Democrats who run private equity firms. Does there need to be regulation? Did you look into attempts to try to pay attention to this, I guess, from a politics standpoint?
Yeah, so I write a lot in the book about attempts at regulation. You're absolutely right that this is not like a clear red-blue divide kind of issue. One thing I learned in the reporting of the book is 88% of members of the House and Senate receive donations from private equity. So that's across both sides of the aisle. So this is, you know, they are a very popular industry on Capitol Hill, also at the state level in many places. And so, for example, on Capitol Hill, Elizabeth Warren has proposed a bill several times, going back to 2018, I think, called the Stop Wall Street Looting Act, that would sort of fundamentally regulate the way private equity operates. That bill has never gotten anywhere close to getting out of committee because, of course, all of her colleagues are taking private equity money and they have no interest in regulating private equity. There has been more progress on the state level in some places, not to regulate private equity out of existence. I don't think any of the people interested in regulating private equity are making like an anti-capitalist, like burn it all down argument. In fact, the argument that they are outlining in a lot of cases is this is actually a corruption of free market capitalism because, you know, in a typical free market capitalist sense, A, you have certain kinds of businesses that are set aside from normal laws of capitalism. But B, one of the fundamental things that you learn in Economics 101 is that the reason free market capitalism works is both parties have equal information. And that is so clearly not happening here. And so on the state level, there have been efforts to keep private equity out of healthcare, for example, or at least dramatically increase scrutiny of those deals. There was a big bill passed in Oregon about private equity and healthcare just maybe 6 weeks ago. So you're starting to see something, but I think without a pretty dramatic change in the composition of Congress, there's unlikely to be a lot of movement on the federal level anytime soon.
That was my next question was, you know, there hasn't been movement at the federal level, but can each state do something, or are private equity firms in the politics of each state too? Are state lawmakers getting donations from private equity?
Yes, certainly. You know, I would say it's more of a thing in states where private equity is, you know, where a lot of them are headquartered, right? Mm-hmm. So I live in New York, and you'll see a lot of private equity donations to politicians in New York. Less so in states where there aren't a lot of firms headquartered. But yes, I mean, you can, there is just more appetite to do regulation on the state level, in part because there's less money from the private equity industry coming in, but also in part because I think state legislators, no matter what party they're a part of, feel an obligation to their constituents that might be a little more personal, a little more ground level than federal lawmakers do, right? So if you are representing a city council district, for example, you are living in that city council district. You are seeing whose housing is being taken away, what businesses are disappearing. One thing that comes up over and over with private equity is they're not based in these communities, right? They, in a lot of cases, have not set foot in the communities they are incredibly powerful in. And so I do think state and local lawmakers tend to see that in a slightly different way, maybe, than it looks from Capitol Hill.
Do you know if the companies that get bought out by private equity firms, are they looking, are they out there looking for a buyer most of the time? Or are they, does the private equity firm come to them and say, wow, have we got a deal for you?
Yeah, it really depends. Often in industries like retail, you know they need a buyer. Mm-hmm. And so they may have a fiduciary responsibility to accept the highest offer, even if that is from a company, you know, a firm that won't be good for them in the long term. In industries like healthcare and housing, you hear a lot about just unsolicited offers. You know, I talked about doctors in private practice who are just constantly getting these unsolicited offers. And I've never spoken to a doctor in private practice who hasn't been approached. And many of these folks are not remotely looking to sell, but you know, sometimes you get an offer worth many orders of magnitude more than what you think your business is worth. And it's pretty tempting.
That offer you can't refuse.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about private equity with Megan Greenwell, author of Bad Company, Private Equity and the Death of the American Dream. Let's talk a little bit more about the people you profile. So you decided to go with, you decided to organize your book by profiling people rather than explaining maybe private equity in a different way. A Toys R Us supervisor, a rural doctor, a local newspaper journalist, and an affordable housing organizer. Now, we don't have time to get into all four of those. So I think we've beat up Toys R Us enough. So maybe we can lean into the affordable housing organizer, because I think that people might not realize that private equity is everywhere, even in your apartment complex, right? Can you explain a little bit of the story of the affordable housing organizer?
Yeah, so this is a woman named Loren DePina who lives in Alexandria, Virginia, just outside of DC. And, you know, she had gone through a lot of financial struggles in her life and had actually gotten out of public housing and made it to this apartment complex that she thought was her dream. You know, she was so happy. There, she had bedrooms for both of her kids. There was a swimming pool outside. It was right across the street from school. She and her family really felt like they had made it. And she didn't know that her landlord was private equity owned. Who does that level of research on their landlord? I know I didn't when I moved into my current rental apartment. And so Loren pretty immediately started realizing that some things were going wrong. You know, she had all sorts of maintenance problems in her building and in her apartment, not just, you know, broken doors, chipping paint, whatever, but really serious leaks that were creating black mold in her apartment and, you know, putting her children at risk. And then there was one night where she had gotten home from an event with her family and she realized that there was this horrific flood flooding every room of her apartment. And she went down to the lobby and realized that there were 14 families in total who were in this situation. And rather than trying to swiftly solve the problem, her landlord was just, you know, trying to paper over it and trying to make it go away as quickly as possible. There's a quote in the book where a representative of the landlord says, essentially, what do you want us to do? If we were going to fix all these pipes, it would cost us months and months worth of rent. And we're not going to do that. Mm-hmm. And so there was, you know, we think of housing as this sort of fundamental right. And if you can pay for it, you are entitled to it. But I think Loren's experience shows really clearly that the goal of private equity is to make money for private equity. The goal is not to provide a service or even to make money off of that service, right? If they can make more money by selling the real estate, by, you know, boosting the rent and getting everybody who currently lives there out, that's what they will do. And they have really targeted housing favored by low-income people who don't have a lot of other options. And so you end up in with this situation where the richest firms in America are driving, you know, some of the most vulnerable people out of America, some of the most vulnerable people in America out of their homes.
The title of your book, in the title of your book, in the subtitle, you call private equity the death of the American dream. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah, so it's not just retail and restaurants and businesses that private equity is going after. It is things that we take for granted are always going to be there, right? So our homes, our healthcare, our sources of information. And more you see private equity sort of devouring these things with very little regard for what it means for the rest of us. I talked about the rural hospital thing where, like, this was not about whether you can pay or not, right? This is not saying everybody should get free healthcare. The hospital that I wrote about in Wyoming was actually a for-profit hospital for many years before private equity came into the picture. But then private equity took it over and, without ever coming into that community, stripped the hospital of its ability to do, you know, even basic surgeries outside of 9 to 5, eliminated the labor and delivery ward altogether. So you could not deliver a baby there. At a certain point, it got so bad that there's a character in the book whose kid was dancing in socks on the coffee table, falls off, needs stitches in his forehead. This very classic childhood injury. And because it was after 5 p.m., this hospital could not stitch up a cut. So they were, you know, 30, 35 miles from the nearest hospital. In the winter, it's through this, like, terrible windswept canyon. And it wasn't a matter of, like, can you pay or can you not? It was a matter of if you live in this community, you do not get healthcare anymore. And so I do argue that private equity has really undermined our ability to, you know, take advantage of the things we need to survive.
I guess we'll just end on your biggest takeaway from the book, but I guess maybe it is the death of the American dream. Do you have another takeaway that you want to leave our listeners with?
I think the thing I'm always trying to emphasize is I've heard from a lot of people who are sort of like, this sounds really interesting, but I wouldn't read that. It's very depressing. But I took this narrative approach because I didn't want this to be a boring book that was sort of an overview. I think readers will really fall in love with these characters. But also, each of these characters have fought back in various ways, from lobbying for regulation to reinventing their industries from the ground up. And so I do think there's a lot of hope here. And I think these characters' stories point to a lot of interesting ways that may show a way forward to anybody who is concerned about big financial firms controlling too much of our lives.
So an individual person can resurrect that dead American dream?
I think a lot of ordinary Americans working together can make a bigger difference than people sometimes assume they can.
Well, I want to thank you so much for your time. Megan Greenwell, author of Bad Company, Private Equity and the Death of the American Dream. Thank you for joining us today on All Sides.
Thanks for having me.
And coming up, we're going to talk about private equity's impact here in Ohio. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
These days, there's so much news, it can be hard to keep up with what it all means for you, your family, and your community. The Consider This podcast from NPR features our award-winning journalism. 6 days a week, we bring you a deep dive on a news story and provide the context and analysis that helps you make sense of the news. We get behind the headlines. We get to the truth. Listen to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Ohio itself is far away from the offices of Wall Street and the New York Stock Exchange, but impacts of deals done on Wall Street are felt in Ohio every day. From a coal plant walking away from $40 million in environmental liabilities, to teachers losing their pensions, to your local pharmacy shutting its doors, how might private equity affect you? And does the average Ohioan need to worry about the impacts of these private equity deals? Joining us now is Marty Schladen, reporter for the Ohio Capital Journal. Welcome back to the show, Marty.
Hi, Amy.
So for the first part of the show, we were looking at the bigger picture of private equity. But do you see this as something that's unraveling here in Ohio businesses?
It definitely is impacting Ohioans. Like, as you referred to, a new private equity firm is in the process of buying the Gavin Coal Plant in southern Ohio on the Ohio River. It is already thought to be the most deadly coal plant in the country. Kills supposedly 200 and some people a year because of its emissions. It has a $40 million coal ash liability that people are concerned that they're not going to clean up.
One of the things we discussed was Megan Greenwell's book called Bad Company, Private Equity and the Death of the American Dream. Now, Ohio is ranked fifth in the nation for businesses and entrepreneurs. So do you think Ohio can sidestep this issue? Is this state a place for the American dream, or do you think private equity is in the midst of interrupting that?
There's no doubt that any big economy is going to be affected by a force as big as private equity. They control probably hundreds of billions of dollars. And so, of course, that's going to radiate out everywhere in the economy.
So Walgreens is being acquired by a private equity firm called Sycamore Partners. The deal is valued at $10 billion. And this will take Walgreens off the public market and transition it to private equity after nearly a century as a public company. So something that you reported on is pharmacy deserts that might be left in underserved rural areas if this sale goes through, where Walgreens could be bought by private equity. Can you tell us a little bit more about how a private equity firm buying Walgreens creates a pharmacy desert?
Well, we already have a huge pharmacy desert problem in Ohio. Last year, we dropped below 2,000 pharmacies, and I don't know anybody who thinks that we're going to get back above that, even though the state's population is growing. Walgreens has been struggling financially. They're already in the process of closing 1,200 stores nationwide. And private equity is known for going in and selling off non-performing assets, loading, as your previous guest said, loading the whole deal up with the debt that it costs to close the deal, that $10 billion you referred to. Mm-hmm. But then they're real quick to get rid of underperforming assets, and those tend to be in these already underserved areas, so that if you're in Wellston, Ohio, or Danville, suddenly there's no pharmacy within 20 miles, and a lot of people don't have transportation. And the pharmacist is not only the place where they get their medicine, it's the one medical professional they actually can talk to on a regular basis about their conditions.
Have you seen communities? Can they save their Walgreens? Like, could private equity firms listen and say, you know, like, maybe it doesn't make a lot of money, but we need it here?
The only instance I've seen of a community saving a pharmacy did not involve any major company. It was a local owner, Denise Conway, partnering with the county to reopen where a CVS had been. But that required government involvement.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about private equity and what's happening with some companies here in Ohio with Marty Schladen, a reporter for the Ohio Capital Journal. So you wrote about the coal plant in southern Ohio that we mentioned that has been bought by private equity. It's called the Gavin Plant, and it's in, is it Cheshire? Is that?
Yes.
Okay. I want to make sure I'm saying it right. So it's in the process of being purchased by two other private equity firms, Energy Capital Partners and Javelin. So this coal plant has been named the deadliest in the nation due to its pollution record. Why would anyone want to buy it?
As it turns out, private equity is much more heavily invested in fossil fuel, particularly coal, than any other ownership structure. I think that part of it is they're getting these plants pretty cheaply because natural gas is a lot cheaper than coal. Renewables are now cheaper than coal normally. But I think what happened this last election cycle, something we're seeing is they dumped a lot of money into political efforts to roll back environmental regulations to make their dirty electricity plants more valuable.
So one of the private equity companies involved in buying this, the Gavin plant, is known for converting plants away from coal. Are they going to do that with this one?
If they are, they won't tell me that. Mm. I've asked repeatedly whether they plan to retire the plant, whether they plan to switch over to some kind of renewables or at least natural gas, which is quite a bit cleaner than coal, and they just won't say.
So a private equity firm owns it now, and two different firms are buying it from the other private equity firm. Do I have that right?
That is correct. So, and it's still in process, in the approval process.
So is it like it seems like a money shell game where it's just money moving around? Is that?
It sure can feel that way. And I think a really important thing that your previous guest test touched on is every time one of these deals happens, there are enormous fees being extracted. So just making the deal itself is valuable to the people doing so.
How about workers at the coal plant or people who live around the coal plant? What's the impact for them when a private equity firm buys a coal plant?
Well, I can't say in this instance. I've not talked to any of those workers, but mm-hmm. Private equity firms have been known to buy companies, get rid of the most expensive employees, turn their backs on the pension plan, do everything they can to make the deal more profitable to them.
Hmm. So there must be money to be made there, though, if they're buying it, even if it has a record as being the deadliest in the nation, because otherwise, why would they buy it?
I think that's exactly right. Now, there is this economically warping incentive that I just talked about, the fees that they charge. Mm-hmm. Just by doing the deal, they're charging fees. And a lot of times it's not their own money they're spending. The way they're financing the deal is by loading debt onto the property they're buying. Mm-hmm. So often what they'll do is I think they did this with Sears. They'll strip the thing out. They'll sell off what they think is most valuable and then declare bankruptcy and walk away. There's many more private equity deals end in bankruptcy than other structured deals.
Mm. Can a coal plant go bankrupt then too?
Then there's this environmental liability, and mm-hmm. the question becomes who pays for that? And way too often the answer is us.
Yeah. I mentioned in the introduction that there's $40 million in environmental liabilities for this coal plant. But if the owner sells, does that go away?
No, it doesn't go away. And coal ash is super toxic. There have been big disasters in West Virginia and Kentucky involving it. And they've got $40 million cleanup of this stuff. And that's another question they've not answered is, are they going to clean that up?
Another one that you wrote about, you also wrote about private equity firms buying up businesses that deal with hospice care. So with Ohio being a massive Medicare spender, do you think private equity's control of many hospitals, do you think it's going to end up driving up medical bills where private equity firms are buying up more of these healthcare centers?
I'm not really sure about that, but the story I wrote focused mm-hmm. on quality of care mm-hmm. when private equity buys hospice care. Mm-hmm. And they're just relentlessly looking for savings. And the finding in that study was that the quality of care got poorer. And I'm sure it's because they were looking for ways to save money.
There's money to be made in healthcare. I mean, the healthcare is a huge business. So buying different hospice care centers kind of makes sense as a way to find somewhere to make some money. Can they, because some of these private equity firms say they're coming in and they're helping. So maybe can they help?
Well, I suppose so. If they say that their goal is anything other than to make money, that's a little disingenuous. Mm. And as a separate book than the one you talked about, Gretchen Mortensen in 2023 and Joshua Rosner wrote an important book about this called These Are the Plunderers. And they talked about how they also have been buying up emergency rooms. And they've kind of, according to the authors of this book, they really did a big role in inventing surprise medical billing. Because once again, the concern isn't really about good patient care or, you know, aftercare. It's about the bottom line.
One other aspect of private equity that you wrote about that people might not even realize is impacting teachers here in Ohio. And they might not realize it. The Ohio State Teachers Retirement System put $1.3 billion into private equity groups. Can you tell me more about that? Why is the STRS putting money into private equity?
Well, in fairness to them, they're not alone. A lot of big pension systems do this, but Ohio is particularly a big spender on private equity. And the authors of the 2023 book say that it's really backward in a lot of ways because, you know, private equity, when they buy up places of work, they have a tendency to try to kick out the union. They've turned their backs on pension plans. And all these pension systems were started on behalf of people who are from that group who are being harmed. You know, it's like adding to income inequality when pension systems were created to act against income inequality. And one thing they said particularly about STRS is that one way they get fees is they will charge fees based on an amount of money committed for a long-term deal, including the money that has not yet been put up. And in this book, they say that those fees amounted to, in 2020, I think, $143 million a year just on what appear to be junk fees that, you know, the people working at the pension system make a lot of money. The people running the private equity firms make even more money. But that's in a pension system that had to stop giving cost of living increases in 2017. They've given a couple of small ones since then, but there was this $143 million a year on fees for money that hadn't even been turned over to the private equity system yet.
So this book you're talking about, does it feature STRS? Is it one of their examples?
Yep.
Is that okay?
Yep.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit more about that. Like, you know, of all the pension plans in all the country, they picked us.
Yeah. Well, and they mentioned some other ones too, like CalPERS, the California Public Employee Retirement System. It's even bigger than STRS. They mentioned them a few times too, but they focused particularly on these fees. And this has been a big, you know, I'm sure listeners have heard this, you know, rumbling about STRS and management. And one of the big questions out there has been, you're paying these huge fees, you know, it's over $1 billion in fees, yet on these, they call them alternative investments, yet you couldn't afford to give us a cost of living increase for 5 years. You know, how does that work? And like I said earlier, too, the salaries at STRS, the workers there are really high by journalistic standards. Anyway. so that's a real question, is who's benefiting from these transactions, the members of the pension system whose money they're managing or the people running the pension system and the people they're doing business with?
Well, and you also wrote that that $1.3 billion that they invested in private equity groups, they picked groups that are heavily invested in big fossil fuel producers. So this private equity group, are they involved in the coal plant we were talking about earlier? Is it all tied together?
Well, I think it is just in a more general sense.
Okay.
Private equity is more heavily invested in the dirtiest kinds of fossil fuel production than any other investment structure. And I think part of that is the way some of this happened. Well, that was nuclear. But, you know, some of this, these deals, the way they work is they're buying a coal plant. You may not see much of a future in a coal plant, but they may not care. They may not be spending their own money, like I said earlier. They might just be loading the thing up with debt. No plans to do any of the environmental cleanup. And they're going to make all their fees no matter what. And then, you know, if the investment holds up over a long period of time, great. If not, they walk away.
What does it mean if STRS is investing in private equity groups that are with fossil fuels? Do we need to worry about that money? You know, if some of these fossil fuel industries go bankrupt and the private equity can just walk away, what happens to STRS's money?
That's a good question. So they could be left holding the bag. Mm-hmm. And then there's a much more straightforward cost that comes with all this. Like, you know, economists call them externalities. We've seen some really bad storms in the United States lately, right? Mm-hmm. That's climate change. We all have to pay for that. With, you know, the reason they call the Gavin plant the deadliest plant in the world is because the Sierra Club estimates that it kills something like 250 people a year with the emissions it puts out and the respiratory diseases it causes. You know, the pensioners are being forced, in essence, to subsidize that.
Well, I want to thank you for your time.
Sure.
We are out of time, but this has been interesting, and I'm sure there's much more to dive into with private equity. But we've been talking with Marty Schladen, reporter for the Ohio Capital Journal. Thank you for joining us.
Sure, Amy.
And this has been All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jurevich, and I want to say thank you to our staff, senior producer Marcus Charleston, producer Aaron Esmont-Rabinowitz, student producers Chris Corcoran, David Stein, Iza Huck, Colin Simpson, and Kiara Burson. And Colin Simpson helped produce this show today. We have video production by the Ohio Channel and board operation by Chris Johnston and Cameron Howard. Be sure to like All Sides on Facebook and follow our show on Instagram at All Sides WOSU. Thanks for listening today.
Today from the Ohio.
These days, there's so much news, it can be hard to keep up with what it all means for you, your family, and your community. The Consider This podcast from NPR features our award-winning journalism. 6 days a week, we bring you a deep dive on a news story and provide the context and analysis that helps you make sense of the news. We get behind the headlines. We get to the truth. Listen to the Consider This podcast from NPR.